The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. Those taking part are Dilys Powell, Frank Muir, Anne Scott James, and Dennis Norton. And here's round one to test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they can give me the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Dilys Powell. Dilys, what is the meaning of flump? F-L-U-M-P, flump. And it could be either a verb or a noun.
Flump? It means to flop with a slump.
Yes, I think you get by on this. Means to move or to fall heavily or to throw somebody down or something down with a dull thumping noise. It can be a noun, can be a verb, and it's obviously an attempt at imitating the noise. Now, Dennis Norton, what's the meaning of impetuous? I-M-P-I-T-E-O-U-S. Impetuous.
Impetuous. Well, I'll tell you, Jack, when you ask us a question that we don't know, and you say, well, I'll give you half a mark for trying. Anne turns to me, and in her real voice, she says, I'd rather have him atus than have him piteous.
Well, you're jolly nearly there.
It's something to do with having no pity.
That's absolutely right. 2 marks. Now, Anne Scott James. Anne, what is slob ice? S-L-O-B, slob, hyphen, ice. Slob ice.
You've pronounced it wrong, Jack. I've been there.
Oh, jolly good.
It's a Yugoslav small little seaport, and it should be pronounced Slobice.
That's a very daring thought.
Our yacht put in there one day.
Yes, a yacht wouldn't like doing this, what this really means.
Well, it's a kind of ice, then, we presume.
A slob
ice. A Knickerbocker glory.
Yeah.
In Yugoslavia. I stick to my part of the...
Eaten in a cinema. In the dark, actually. Which is so that when you come out, you find flavour of the month all down your lapel.
Or do you...
Well, it should be.
It's a Czechoslovak Knickerbocker glory.
I should lay off this idea of eating...
Well, it's a kind of ice.
Exactly. It's a moron glacé.
Look, we can't do better than that. We can't... No, that's it.
It's a name for floating ice. Mixed with snow, and you don't find it in Yugoslavia, at least not very much. You're much more likely to find it off Newfoundland. Rather like flow ice or cat ice, that kind of ice, not the edible type. Frank Mill, what's the meaning of lapidify? L-A-P-I-D-I-F-Y, lapidify.
It's not a word you hear all that frequently. lapidify. It's an imperative. It's a word you shout to make all possible speed, because lapid is the Chinese word for fast. So lapidify means make all rapidity.
It's turned to stone. Turned to a small stone.
We think it's to do with stonifying. Being turned into a piece of stone.
That's absolutely dead right. Lapidify means to make into stone or to become stone, as when you see a gorgon's head or something and stop being alive and become a stone monument. Lapidify. Now, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I want the 2 women members of the team to go on studying those quotations, because at the end, I shall ask them where those quotations come from, their source. Beginning with Dilys Powell and Frank Muir, here's your quotation. He jests at scars that never felt a wound. And Anne Scott James and Dennis, here's yours. Rather bear those ills we know than fly to others we know not of. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Next round's about verse and poetry, and what I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with a line or two following. 2 marks if they can finish off the quotation, and 2 marks for correctly naming its source. beginning with Dillis Powell. If parts allured thee, think how Bacon shined, the wisest, brightest, meanest of mankind, or ravished with the whistling of a name. I want one more line.
He is no better, he is much the same. Shiny Bacon, I've never heard that.
It rhymes.
Let's have the author first. You can get
18th
there.
Century.
Yes.
Should we try Pope?
Yes.
Try Pope.
Yeah.
Pope.
Tis Alexander Pope, yes.
Alexander Pope.
Yes.
Is this the Dunciad?
No. Essay on Man. If parts allure thee, think how Bacon shined, the wisest, brightest, meanest of mankind, or ravished with the whistling of a name, see Cromwell, damned to everlasting fame.
Well,
now, Dennis Norden, I was promised on a time to have reason for my rhyme from that time unto this season. And one more line.
Then a rhyme and reason.
That's right. Do you remember who did it?
That was sheer guesswork.
That's jolly good.
No, I don't. I don't, and I'm not.
Well, it is a very difficult one. There is a sort of pendant to this.
Oh, I like
when that rather sort of awkward bureaucrat, the first Lord Burleigh, William Cecil, said, "What? All this for a song?" Did that help?
Oh, yes. Now, this was something to do with the poet, or the, it wasn't the poet laureate, but it was one of the first writers to be given a state grant.
That's it.
Now,
remember
who
it was?
Who was it? Spencer.
Yes, well done.
Well done.
Three out of four, because I did give quite a lot of help. I was promised on a time to have reason for my rhyme. From that time unto this season, I received nor rhyme nor reason. Three out of four. Now, Anne Scott James, then it's Tommy this and Tommy that and Tommy, how's your soul?
But it's good old Tommy.
Yes,
where's his Kipling? Kipling,
yes.
Surely.
No, I know the other bit.
Say our bit again. Tommy this
and Tommy that. And Tommy, how's your soul?
Boot inspection, yes. Oh, is it some other role?
Yes.
Is it some other role?
No. Role is the end, but it isn't your kind of role.
Oh, it's your role. Your pack. Yes, where's your pack? Wrap your pack and clean your
boots. And do a rock and roll.
Boots. Yes. and tidy up your role.
Let's have the title of the poem, which is very easy.
Tommy Atkins.
All right. Three again, I think, out of four. Then it's Tommy this and Tommy that and Tommy how's your soul, but it's thin red line of Euros when the drums begin to roll, and it's Tommy or Tommy Atkins by Rudyard Kipling. Now, Frank Muir, if of all words of tongue and pen the saddest are it might have been, more sad are these we daily see.
Things are not what they used to be.
You're very nearly right.
I very nearly get 3 marks.
Author?
No, it doesn't spring readily to mind. Jack.
Transatlantic gentleman.
Emerson? No, not.
No, one out of four. If of all words of tongue and pen, the saddest hour it might have been, more sad are those we daily see, it is but hadn't ought to be. You've only nearly got that bit. Oh, and it's by Bret Hart in a poem, for reasons best known to him, called Mrs. Judge Jenkins. One out of four, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, the next round's about origins and derivations. 3 marks if I am given the present meaning and then am given the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Beginning with Dillis Powell, the Louvre. L-O-U-V-R-E, the Louvre.
Well, we keep the V-R-E on the end. The Louvre is now a museum, a national gallery in Paris.
Yes. What was it before it was a portrait gallery or a picture
it's
gallery?
A palace.
Yes.
It had sort of special windows, which were called louvres.
Or louvres.
Or louvres.
2.5, I think. Bit of help there.
Yes, right.
The former royal palace of the French kings, and since then, as Dillis Powell quite rightly says, the greater part of it, though not the whole of it, has been used as a national museum and art gallery. But the more likely explanation is that in medieval times in Paris, when Paris was a very much smaller town, it was always in winter beleaguered by hungry wolves, and the main route in to the town, along which the food carts came, was past this palace of the Louvre, And the wolves sort of sat up and waited, and sometimes ate the food, and sometimes ate the chaps who were accompanying the food. And the, if you remember, although the masculine for a man wolf is Lou, the female wolf is Louve, L-O-U-V-E. So this is the place where the wolves waited up for you.
Female ones.
Female ones. 2.5. Dennis Norton, Doch and Doris.
Well, Doch and Doris is what you have afore ye gang a war.
Yes.
Whatever that is. it's a kind of one for the road.
Yes, absolutely right. And do you know what it...
No, I know that... I think Doris is a Scottish word for door.
Yes, that is.
We used to call doors Doris. A doch, I suppose, is a... I wonder if it would be like a dash of...
Yes.
A dash of spirit or something.
That's it. It's, of course, one of Harry Lauder's most famous songs. It's the final drink before saying goodnight. One for the road, the sort of thing the Minister of Transport doesn't much like. And the Gaelic originally means Dioch and Doris, a drink at the door. So Dennis got it quite right. 3 marks. And Scott James, Jerusalem artichokes.
Well, it's the kind of artichoke which grows at the end of a long stalk.
Yes.
In an exquisite lily-shaped form. And believe it or not, it used to grow in, near, and around Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Must have something to do with Jerusalem.
None at all. Nothing whatever.
No.
Well, come on, let's think of some marvellous French derivation.
It's a kind of sunflower. It has a long stalk, as we said. And it's nothing whatever to do with Jerusalem, which is just a corruption of the word girasole, or girasol, which simply means a plant that turns round as the sun turns. Now, Frank Muir, anathema.
Anathema is a sort of thickness where you have difficulty in getting a... drawing your breath. Also, it's, or used to be, what? Come on. Didn't it used to be an abomination against the gods?
Yes, it can mean that.
It was something quite extraordinary.
Yes.
It's a Greek word.
Yes.
It's a Greek word.
Can you remember the...
Well, bold.
Very yes. Good, yes.
Now, can you remember the verb it comes from, Dillis?
Anatathemi.
Yes. Absolutely right.
Speak down.
Yes. It's, the original verb meant just to dedicate or devote. And it originally started off devoting something to God or to the church. And later on, still the same thing, when sailors got wrecked, they would hang up their wet clothes because they were so pleased that God had delivered them, or cripples hung up their crutches when they recovered the use of their legs again, and even retired workmen would sometimes hang up their sort of work basket of tools inside it. And then it came to mean devoted to bad, that is, accursed. Accursed of the church or accursed of God. But to start with, it hadn't got that bad sense attached to it. 1.5. Well, now we come to the who, why, how, and what department. 2 marks for correct answers. Dennis Powell, of what was Charles Lamb writing when he said, it's a pistol let off at the ear, not a feather to tickle the intellect?
Somebody's book.
No, it's a particular...
An object.
Not object, no.
An object. Yeah, what
what's going on during
really?
The Lamb's time?
Yes.
That's about 1840 of them.
Oh, a bit earlier.
Well, maybe if it's a young lamb.
No. Come on. It's a pun.
Yes.
A pun. No marks. Dennis Norton, of whom was Leigh Hunt writing when he said, this Adonis in loveliness was a corpulent man of 50.
Well, just simply going from who's your fat friend.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, the only corpulent person who kind of sticks out during that era is the Prince Regent.
Yes. Well done. Get your 2 marks. It was Leigh Hunt, this Adonis in loveliness, was a corpulent man of 50, referring to the Prince Regent, who afterwards became George IV, in a magazine called The Examiner in 1812. But he did it once too often, because next year, 1813, he and his brother were both sentenced to 2 years' imprisonment for making nasty remarks about the Prince Regent in their paper. And Scott James, in his nonsense novels, Stephen Leacock wrote, Lord Ronald said nothing. He flung himself from the room, flung himself on his horse, and where did he ride?
Oh, well,
I don't know. Where did he ride?
Well, Frank and I have rather stake in this because we once did a program with Peter Ustinov, which had this title. He rode off madly in all directions.
Well done. You get your 2 marks again. Nonsense novels, the one called Gertrude the Governess. Now, Frank Muir, who, in reply to what question, replied, "Ignorance, madam, pure ignorance"?
Latter half of the 18th century, at a party, just after Dr. Johnson's dictionary had been published, a lady said, "Why did you describe a horse's pastern in your dictionary as a horse's knee?" And he replied, "Ignorance, madam, ignorance."
Well done, Frank. 2 very well-earned marks. And now we come to the last round and go back to those 2 quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Lewis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation? "He jests at scars that never felt a wound."
It's by William Shakespeare.
Yes.
And it comes in Romeo and Juliet.
Yes. Do you remember who said it?
Romeo.
He did, quite right. Well done. Now, Anne Scott-James, the origin of your quotation, "Rather bear those ills we know than fly to others we know not of."
Well, it's Hamlet.
Yes.
By Hamlet.
By Hamlet, yes.
Not of.
Written by William Shakespeare.
Yes.
And it's the "to be or not to be."
Quite right.
Speech.
And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir. "He jests at scars that never felt a wound."
Well, I remember thinking, what am I going to get for Christmas this year? And I rather thought what I'd get. I had an idea it would either be a first edition of C.P. Snow's novel, The Masters, or model of Liverpool Street Railway Station, made out of used postage stamps. I just had a feeling I was going to get one of those. I didn't, actually. You know what I got for Christmas? Virus pneumonia. It wasn't all I got for Christmas, obviously, you know. I also got pleurisy as well. When I semi-recovered from this little lot, the doctor said to me, "You've got to give up smoking cigarettes." And this didn't worry me at all. Not a bit. You know, I'm used to giving things up. I've given up all sorts of things in my time. I used to always have to walk on the intersections between paving stones. But I gave that up. Now I just walk very carefully so that I always step on the paving stone and never touch one of the lines. I conquered that. But really, giving up cigarettes is quite different. It needs a positive. It just needs a positive attitude of mind. That's all it is. It's a simple attitude of mind. I will give up cigarettes, you say to yourself. It's equivalent to saying, I'll cut my foot off. Perfectly simple. All you've then got to do is do it. Oh, it was horrible. Absolutely terrible. I can't tell you that period. It was absolutely awful. So I went back to the specialist, and I said, "Look, I don't think I can give cigarettes. I've tried and tried." And he said, "Well, you've only been to the front door and back." He said, "You can smoke those cigar things. They're perfectly all right." So I tried smoking cigars. They're terrible things. They laughed at inculcating. You know, those big cigars are like sort of burnt bananas. I tried the small ones first, those little sort of half little things, you know. They always go out halfway through. I could not keep them going. They just go out halfway. I was a victim of midwifery. So I moved on to the big ones. Well, I couldn't light the big ones to start with, because unlike the small ones, the big ones have only got a hole one end, you know. It took me quite a while to appreciate this. And I couldn't make the hole, because my front teeth don't join in the middle. It's held me back. I can't eat corn on the cob. And I couldn't bite the bit off the end. And if you cut it with a rather blunt penknife, the whole cigar sort of gently unwraps. You know, it's got a sort of brown piece of paper on the outside which unwraps and leaves in your hand rather like those, that wrinkly chocolate stuff. A sort of flaky chocolate. Miss Tedderburn, and you get a mouthful of sort of dead cabbage. Absolutely awful. So I thought, well, really the thing to do is to combine the two, is to have a sort of some sort of long thin cigar which will keep going. Now a pipe keeps going, and you don't get bits in your mouth. So if there's some way of incorporating cigar tobacco with a long thin pipe. And then one day, by sheer chance, I was in a magic shop. I'd actually gone in that sells jokes and things. I'd gone in to buy one of those squirting buttonholes. They were those carnations which squirt water. Because you know what it's like when you're on the railway station and your train is about 8 minutes to go and you go in for a cup of coffee and the coffee's always too hot. So what I'd do is I just lean forward gently and give it a squirt of cold water. While I was buying this squirting carnation, I suddenly saw a magic wand. It was an ordinary common or garden magic wand, black with white ends, and the ends come off, and the black bit is long, thin, and hollow. And you're meant to stuff up it coloured handkerchiefs and doves and rabbits and fried eggs and cakes and things, and then produce them to amaze and mystify your friends. Any number can enjoy it. So it suddenly occurred to me that if I bought this magic wand and unrolled a cigar and stuffed it down, and then if I carved with my slightly blunt penknife a mouthpiece, rather like a pipe mouthpiece, I might well have the answer. And you know, I had. I smoked that ever since. So don't in future, like I did originally, mock cigars, as Shakespeare himself said. He jests at cigars that never filled a wand.
Well, I think we're all very happy that Frank survived. And now we go on to Dennis Norden. And if you remember, his quotation was, "Rather bear those ills we know than fly to others we know not of."
Well, I'm asking you to join me tonight in a campaign. You have just heard, Jack has just quoted, one of the show-stopping bits from Hamlet's hit soliloquy, "To be or not to be." I'd remind you that later on in that same hit show, there is another line which says, "Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offence?" To offend, at the time when Hamlet was pacing the windy battlements of Elsinore, to offend meant to murder a boy's father, or to break 8 out of the 10 commandments. Now let us think what to offend means today. It means to use the wrong kind of soap. All over television, all over the underground, every paper you pick up, you have this insistent voice that says, "Do you offend?" Take that poor girl in that television commercial who comes out of a ballroom with beads of moisture on her brow, and her mate immediately rushes over and hisses at her that she should use a deodorant. Surely it would have been much simpler if she just told her to dance slower. And the word deodorant, you see, what I'm getting at is the word deodorant itself is a fraud. See, to deodor should mean to take the odor away. But that's not what a deodorant does. A deodorant takes the odor away and replaces it with another odor, which is worse. I mean, you've seen those things they have for getting rid of kitchen smells. You buy one, and suppose you have your kitchen smelling like someone has just been boiling cabbage. So you take one of these canned things and you press it all around, and what happens? Your kitchen now smells like someone has been stewing carnations. I put you there. There is nothing to choose, and it's creeping up on us. And the trouble is, you see, that these deodorants are getting larger. Anybody who's got a bathroom shelf will know that. They're beginning to take over from the aspirins and things like that. They are larger in themselves. There is now a 1 gallon tin of spray deodorant. Can you imagine the power that there is stored up within a gallon? One false move in a morning, you could blow your arm off. That is why I am asking you all tonight, stamp out these unnatural perfumes, these unknown palms. Genius is supposed to be 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration. Let's keep it that way, and as Hamlet said in the A side of his hit, rather bear those smells we know than fly to odors we know not of.
That was splendid. By your vote, nevertheless, Frank Muir just wins the contest of the two stories, but the entire program, putting all the questions together, is won by the team of Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.